gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
And welcome to this edition of the Hagmann Report. It is October 31st, Tuesday, 2017. Terror in New York City. A Muslim terrorist attack. In our sympathies, our hearts go out to the victims of this terrorist attack. Our prayers go out to them. Our sympathies, our thoughts. Eight dead, over a dozen wounded. Look, it just happened after 3 o'clock where individual named or identified as Saifullo Saipov from one of the Stand countries originally, either Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan, unsure which one. I'm getting feedback, by the way, in my ears, just as an FYI. Why is that?
Sounds like a news. There we go.
Yeah, there we go. That's okay. Thank you. Oh, the insanity. I'm getting insanity in my ear, just to kind of mimic Lawrence O'Donnell. No. But our hearts and prayers go out to the victims in New York City. But having said that, welcome to the new normal. You know, de Blasio and Cuomo had a news conference there, and I look at them as well as all of our leadership as blood being on their hands. That's the way I see it, and no apologies about that statement. You want a sewage pit, not a melting pot, but a sewage pit in this country, and that's exactly what you're going to get by the failure to vet or to just invite everyone into this country, this borderless Western Hemisphere. You globalists, you've got blood on your hands. Now, let me tell you what we just very quickly from what I've been able to determine. This guy came into the country. The first trace of him is 2010 when he was issued his social security number. Originally in Cincinnati, Ohio, there was an address there, also a location in Fort Myers, Florida, and one, the latest, which appears to be in the 5500 block of Granada Drive. It's an apartment building in Tampa, Florida. All right. Now, I posted some of this on my Twitter feed at Hagmann PI, but I think maybe it might have gone over to Hagmann Report as well. But the fact of the matter is, he exited a vehicle. He rented a Home Depot truck in Jersey City, came into New York via one of the tunnels, I believe it was the Lincoln Tunnel, whichever one's down there at the bottom end. And nonetheless, he drove a number of blocks on a bike path, just ripping apart the people in his way, gets out of the vehicle with a paintball gun and a BB gun or a pellet gun, yells Allahu Akbar, and is shot by a New York City police officer, either in the leg or in the abdomen. Don't know where, but he's at a local hospital. I mean, it's all over the place. Look, you know,
that's where he's shot.
Yeah, in the butt, in the leg, in the abdomen. I mean, I'll tell you what, it's you know.
But this whole thing's crazy. And the press conference, you know.
Yeah, how much did you learn from that, John?
Oh, my
gosh. Did you learn anything from that press conference except to say, well, you know, it's how great New York is?
I know. Right? That's what really bothered me. You know, these New Yorkers were out on a beautiful day enjoying the West Side. And I saw James Woods got it exactly right on his Twitter feed. He called it for what it was, and that's grandstanding. That's exactly what
what
we saw it as. And it was a terrible press conference. You had Cuomo and de Blasio there, a double whammy.
And a double whammy indeed.
And, you know, yeah.
Tweedledum and Tweedledee, but, or Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, but the fact is, the perpetrator's name is Saifullo Saipov, again, from one of the Stand countries, 96% Muslim.
I think Uzbekistan.
That's kind of where I'm leaning. He's got addresses last known, apparently, in Tampa, Florida, from Granada Drive. It's an apartment house. By the way, in that apartment, house, there's others of similar, origin, shall we say, living there with them. Also Fort Myers. An address shows up there, and it looks like he came in or was initiated in this country via Cincinnati, Ohio. That Cincinnati one is just kind of out there. There's also with that, there's an arrest showing in St. Louis, Missouri. And also, I've got a year of birth in 1988. I'm not going to give any more information out about this guy. That's just what I've been able to find out that I could verify. The bottom line here is, you know, welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the America crafted by the progressive communist socialists in this country. This is what we're seeing today. And to those who make apologies, that AM Joy, what is wrong with that person? What is wrong with the people that are out there thinking that, well, you know, we really can't say it's a Muslim terrorist attack? What is it? A Halloween prank? What's wrong with you people? You progressive, boy, I'll tell you what, don't get me started. But the bottom line is that, I'm not gonna go and repeat what I said. Also, on this morning show, my morning show, I went into the, I played a couple of clips from Tucker Carlson only because he really gave a very, very good overview of what the indictments were all about. Also, I've got information that there's additional indictments, sealed indictments.
I heard four.
Yeah, anywhere between four, and I heard one double-digit number, but I don't believe I think it's four indictments, perhaps the numbers from that indictment, the targets being in the double digits, lower double digits, but I'm not going to commit to that. But the whole intent here, Joe, and I want everyone to know this, the whole intent here is to destabilize, to delegitimize, and to take down Donald Trump as the President of the United States, and hence come after us. And I found it very interesting that Tucker Carlson got a cease and desist order or letter from the, Tony Podesta's law firm. Okay. You know what I say to that? Bite me. All right. Seriously, you got to be out of your mind. And Tucker Carlson, I give him a lot of credit for that because, as far as I'm concerned, this is, and look, anyone who hasn't gotten a cease and desist letter, and that includes us, you're not doing your job. Call these globalist scumbags out for what they are. You think I'm in a bad mood today?
Well, we have both of our guests with us. And just real quick, I know you touched on this on your show today, the retroactive filings that were done by the Podesta group on their DOJ disclosures in August were the same as forms that Manafort was arrested for.
August. Very quickly. Look, all the counts were under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. Okay. To give you an idea of how ludicrous this is, since 1966, only six filings under that FARA Act have been conducted. Six. You know how many convictions? One. All right. And by the way, Mueller, Guess what? This is not a special counsel crime. This is a law enforcement crime. It's not a special counsel crime. So guess who was the top chief law enforcement officer during the majority of the time this criminal activity was being committed? Allegedly, Robert Mueller as head of the FBI. How do you like that? All right, I'm done.
We have our guests with us, Steve Quayle from stevequayle.com. And we have a special guest with Steve in hour number one, Andrew Basiago. He's going to be with us for the first hour. Then Pastor Langford will join us in hours two and three. Steve, welcome to the show.
I need some pastoring.
I'm going to turn it over to you, buddy.
Well, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, tonight is following on, again, the grips of another Muslim terrorist attack. And Basiago and Como couldn't deny it this time. I heard Doug's introduction, and until we get real and identify the problem, people will be needlessly murdered in the streets. But there is coming a day of backlash, and that's what this whole provocation false flag is designed to do. There are people that I've got a new equation, Doug, Andrew, and Joe. It's called the NT3 equation. And what we're going to talk about tonight is the planet Mars. But NT3 stands for Never Tell the Truth. We have never been lied to a greater degree by a parallel society that is above the law, that basically kills who they want to kill, murders who they want to murder, destroys who they want to destroy, uplift who they want to uplift, and ultimately answer to Satan. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight, this is a serious, this isn't our equivalent of the Hagmans and Quayle's War of the Worlds, but I want to introduce a gentleman who I have followed for a number of years, and I believe one of the brightest men I've ever had the pleasure recently to talk to, but to follow. I'm talking about Andrew Basiago, and I've pronounced your name wrong. It's Basiago, and I apologize for that over all the years, but the point being is we're going to talk about Mars. Mars is going to be the preeminent theme for 2018 and on, and you can take it to the bank. Now, I'm going to just say one thing, and I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Basiago and have him talk about the ideas of just the cover-up of what's really going on in the secret space program. I know from five different sources, independent of Dr. Basiago, I'll get it right, what he's talking about happens to be true. And these five men are unknown to each other. One of them's former highest ranking special operations general, active duty, a member of MAGIC, two Green Berets who were in a space fleet, one a spy, a full scale spy, and another gentleman who is in the no such agency, NSA, who can verify pretty much everything that Dr. Basiago says. So, Andrew, share with people the importance of Mars, and let's just talk about Mars as the basis for tonight, because we only got an hour, and you and I will come back on together and do a whole show with the Hagmans, but share your experience as a child and the whole secret space program that parallels what we've always known as the Saturn rocket program. Go ahead, sir.
Right. Well, as a child, I wasn't going to Mars, but I was a participant in DARPA's Project Pegasus, which was the U.S. time-space exploration program at the time of the emergence of different forms of time travel in the U.S. defense technical community. My late father was a project principal because he was one of the nation's experts in Tesla teleportation, having repeated Tesla's teleportation work when my father was an engineer at the Thomas A. Edison Research Laboratory in West Orange, New Jersey, where he was employed from 1956 to 64. So in the mid-1960s, 66, 67 time frame, when there was a decision made to launch a secret space program around different forms of quantum access resulting from time travel, my dad was brought in as one of the project principals. He was basically a defense community engineer with a classified clearance who had reporting requirements to the CIA, to the Navy, the Air Force, and other U.S. agencies. And my father brought me into those activities in 1968 when we went up to the old Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, and we jumped through a Tesla teleporter to the New Mexico State Capitol grounds in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Then, during my college years at UCLA, from 1980 to 84, I was brought in to the CIA's Mars Jump Room program. And in that capacity, during my training in 1980, I and several other participants were asked to analyze a 4-inch-thick dossier of French intelligence documents, which revealed that American astronauts first went to Mars in 1964. So there has been an over 50-year cover-up of the fact that Mars has been the focus of not just remote study via satellites and rovers, but has been a place that American personnel have been sent to. I first went to Mars in July of 1981 from a space elevator located at a Hughes aircraft facility in El Segundo, California, not their headquarters building, but another facility that Hughes owned and operated at 999 North Sepulveda in El Segundo, right south of the Los Angeles International Airport. And so I've been speaking out for a number of years now about my involvement in those two classified projects because I think the American people have a right to know the state of the art of what our civilization has developed technically, and also the true natural history of the cosmos that we inhabit, including the fact that not just the universe, but our own solar system is inhabited. We are not alone, even in our own solar system.
Given the fact that this is a well-known fact within the defense intelligence community, and the entire new focus on Mars, and even the teleportation of single photons, and some of the headlines that are starting to make the news again, obviously, that now they believe that there's life on Mars and the volcanic tunnels, that there's water on Mars, and all everyone's interest in it. Do you think this is just their way of trying to bring everybody up to speed slowly but surely?
No, I don't follow that line of reasoning. I believe they're perpetuating a cover-up through creating a false picture of what's on Mars and what's not on Mars. Mars is an inhabited planet. Human beings from Earth were going there in antiquity during the High Egyptian civilization. My own organization that I founded, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, has proven that by showing the image that we found on Mars of the an intaglio of the head of a pharaoh on a slab of rock or metal that the rover Spirit captured photographically on its 2012th day on Mars. There are several types of humanoid species on Mars. One group are the descendants of the humans from Earth who were going there in antiquity. Another are the original indigenous Martians. There are water deposits there. There is enough oxygen in the Martian atmosphere to produce blue skies on Mars. They've been concealing that by manipulating the color scheme of the images that are being sent back. Oxygen is a clear gas, hence it refracts blue, just as it does in our atmosphere. Humans from Earth can breathe the Martian atmosphere. It's very thin. It's about what the oxygen levels are at 12,000 feet on Earth. But one can actually survive and function on Mars, even without a respirator. I did so myself in approximately 40 round trips there between July of 1981 and May of 1984 when I was active in the program. We believe there are around 1,500 visitors going to Mars during that time period. I don't know, because I haven't been in the program for 30 years, how many Earthlings are there today, but the estimates go as high as 500,000. So I believe these incremental releases of information by NASA and other agencies are not so much the controlled release of information or an acclimation program, but are an active disinformation program to conceal the fact that Mars is inhabited. We were going there in antiquity. We've been sending American astronauts there since 1964, and there is an active colonization program underway.
The Russians, Chinese, everyone has decided that Mars is in their focus. Obviously, you and I spoke yesterday at length, and you encountered some Russian, what would we call them, portal knots? What do you call guys who have been there?
Well, recently I've been calling the Mars jumpers astronauts, because really we were, except we've been denied the dignity of being referred to as such, because of course there were never Kodak ectochrome photographic portraits of us taken in these heroic white spacesuits. I've also been popularizing the term chrononaut, because what really secretly emerged, when we talk about the secret space program, we're really talking about the emergence of different modalities of time travel. So I think it's more accurate to call us chrononauts, but at the same time I'm trying to apply the term astronaut to the cadres that I were part of, because we deserve to be included among the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts. In fact, we were doing more difficult things. We were going farther distances more often with greater levels of danger than the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts, often at half the age of the official overt astronaut corps. And so I really have been using both of those terms, but I guess my preferred term is chrononaut. Now, in terms of the Soviet-Russian presence, we crossed paths on one jump to Mars with a group of Soviets, and we also had several personal encounters with a British team, not just on one jump, but on multiple jumps. So we know that the United States, the United Kingdom, and the former Soviet Union were sending astronauts, if you will, or chrononauts, if you want to be more accurate, in the early 1980s to the Red Planet, and we were returning them safely to the Earth.
it's hard for people to understand. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, Andrew is a member of Mensa. And again, I want to share something, Doug and Joe, why this is so difficult for people to understand, but it's so important. If you tried to talk about this, and Andrew, you know this, for the past however many years you've been talking about it, you just can't get past the, if you will, the official party line. But yet now, with all of the, and there is breaking news on teleportation and a new understanding of quantum physics, the idea is that what could not be received a decade ago is now seemingly, in my opinion, it's God's timing to reveal the, if you will, the secrets that have been hidden and that have been covered up by our government. Did you ever personally encounter any of the men in black?
Actually, in really, yes, but in no connection with my time traveler Mars experiences. Actually, what happened was, in the summer of 1968, my father and I were watching a New York Mets baseball game in the living room of our home in Morris Plains, New Jersey, and a huge lenticular craft came over the neighborhood. We heard the it was making no sound, but we heard the three multiple rotor helicopters that were escorting it. Size reference to, let's say, if the craft, the ET craft, was about the size of a pelican, the helicopters would be about the size of mosquitoes or bumblebees. And they were escorting it on a Philadelphia to New York vector. And my father and I looked up at it, and I asked my dad what it was, and he said, you know, I don't know, son, but I can tell you this. It wasn't built by any country on this planet. And he was an informed observer. He was essentially an expert witness of what he was viewing, because my dad was one of the co-developers of the ramjet. He actually designed the metal alloy by which the ramjet would be built at Curtiss Wright. He was sent there in October of 1952 to help build the ramjet after the famous July 1952 overflight of Washington, D.C., by nine ET crafts, clocked at traveling at 7,000 miles per hour by Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, and also seen to be jumping around in the sky, indicating that they had a teleportation capability. So my dad was brought into the classified work of the defense technical community at that time, and would go on to work on a number of other very sensitive classified projects, including the B-70, which was going to be the atomic power source equipped strategic bomber. We then walked home and watched the rest of the baseball game. That was on a Saturday or Sunday. It was the summer. The next Tuesday morning, two men in black came to the front stoop, the front door of our house, and briefly questioned my mother as to whether we had seen anything strange in the neighborhood. And they were right out of the men in black literature, with the Blues Brother clothing, you know, the dark suits and hats and the strange demeanor and so forth. My mother then returned to her housework, and I stepped out on the front stoop and watched them approach every family all the way up the street, you know, go to every door, front door, and repeat their brief interrogation of our neighbors, as they had done, asking my mom whether we had seen anything strange. So I did have a Men in Black experience as a child around the time that I was initially placed in Project Pegasus, but I don't believe it had any connection to my classified work for the government. I think it was just a MIB encounter related to that overflight.
Did you undergo, obviously, and again, ladies and gentlemen, I want to share something. Dr. Bajago is he's a believer in Jesus, and I really prayed about, Lord, is this the time to reveal this? And I have. And Dr. Bajago, I apologize for, I don't know, when I get a pronunciation in my mind, I stick with it until, you know, a year later, but I'll try and hit it right. The timing of this program, Doug and Joe and everyone listening, is so critical. I don't have the answers to, you know, I only have the answers to that which is revealed. But I want to share this. 1 week ago, I got a call, Andrew, from basically one of the guys that was one of the first, if you will, in the Space Command, who was on Mars, and he was on Mars as a warrior fighting stuff there. And he talked about having his mind wiped. My other friend, formerly with the NSA, talked about having his mind wiped. And then, obviously, the MIBs, Men in Black, even with the Spielberg presentation, always there was always, if you will, the presentation of mind wipe. Do you find that you recall things now? Was that ever done to you, number one? And are you recalling things different times that are coming back to you?
Well, in terms of my time travel experiences in the early 70s, there was an attempt made when I left the project at the end of the summer of 1972 to suppress my memories by essentially via torture. Basically, I had a tremendous headache, a kind of a, just an evacuating, terrible headache induced while I was being spoken to in a kind of a hypnotic voice that this is what will happen. You'll have a terrible headache like this when you recall what you did in the project. But through force of will, basically through soul force, and reliance on Almighty God, I defeated that. And therefore I brought forward through the balance of, you know, the rest of my life to this point, memories of my time travel experiences. But then 10 years later, after serving from 1980 to 84 and going to Mars from 81 to 84 in the Mars Jump Room program, they were utilizing a reverse engineered American version of the Soviet LIDA machine. It's LIDA. An acronym for a Soviet term for that device. And they were very effectively suppressing or blocking our memories without using torture, but rather with using the, not the electronic dissolution of memory, but simply the electronic blocking of memory. So I only ended up recovering my Mars visitation memories when I was approached by my fellow jumpers, William Brett Stillings, Bernard Mendez, and William Whitecrow, who had also served with me back in the day when I was a child. He was actually my martial arts instructor when I was time traveling for DARPA in the early 70s. So had it not been for the connectivity of the internet and the ability to reach out to others and contact them after decades of not being in touch with them, I don't think any of the four of us would have remembered with the certainty and the clarity that we now have what happened in the Mars program. But I'm absolutely certain, based on our hundreds of hours of discussions together, that we are not deluding each other, because we have verified very esoteric facts and shared them with each other and used each other to get around those memory blocks.
It's almost as we're seeing even the, if you will, the neuropharmaceuticals and the electronic blocking of synapses. I mean, that's even in the news in the past couple months, where they're talking about getting rid of the part of the brain that is a conscience or the God center of our brain. The supernatural evil. What did you perceive a change or experience a change where there were some really good men in the program, as your father, who was a believer in Jesus Christ, and others? And then was there, I guess you'd say, an envelope of evil that came in and pretty much took over the program that it now exists under?
I wouldn't say that evil won. I would say there was certainly a dichotomy between the really high-caliber people who sort of embodied the greatest generation, men like Dr. Harold M. Agnew at the Los Alamos National Labs, Dr. Sterling Colgate, my father, who again was one of the nation's experts on teleportation. They were really good people. And, you know, if you think of, for example, let me just use my dad as an example. My dad was born in 1923 on the kitchen table in Summit Hill, Pennsylvania, an impoverished Irish-American and Polish-American coal mining town in the anthracite coal mining country of eastern Pennsylvania. He was eating two meals a day of apple butter and toast during the Depression as a 10-year-old. He was 130 pounds when he served as a combat medic and ambulance driver in World War II in France and Germany. He only became an engineer after going back to the coal mines after the war as a result of the GI Bill. He got an engineering degree from Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And then he was invited into the defense technical community and its secret projects as a result of his expertise as a physicist, an inventor, an electrical engineer. And yet he went from those origins to making a material contribution to the advent of time travel, not even as a mid-career professional, beginning essentially when he was still in his early 40s. So I think my dad is sort of an example of the quality of the individuals that generation was producing and how far they went from their roots if we then evaluate what they were doing as mid-career professionals. So there was, I was very, very cosmically privileged to be a direct participant in the development of a new forms of human functioning in the universe that that great generation was achieving. And I think, in fact, was the greatest feat that they achieved, even more grand than the lunar landing, for example, or some of the medical advances that they were responsible for developing. But there was an evil faction in the program that had no compunction, for example, about electromagnetically shocking us by 1971 when we would teleport from New Mexico back to New Jersey so that we wouldn't talk about the teleportation technology. There was clearly a faction that not only had no compunction about utilizing us as children in the program, but even essentially abusing us in the process. So there was a dichotomy. Do I think that that was a kind of a satanic incubus? It might have been. I think more is coming out about the satanic cult in the world. I mean, if you look at the recent interviews of Ronald Bernard, the Dutch banker, he literally provides gripping testimony about the fact that at the highest levels of banking, you have to become not only a Satanist, but a Satanist willing to ritualistically sacrifice children to remain safe and advance in the field. So there could have been a satanic connection to the abusive and sort of hard-hearted people in the program. I don't think necessarily that was true, and I don't think necessarily that the evil faction won. But I think one of the reasons I'm speaking out is, after all these years, we really don't know who is in control of the technology. It may, for example, be a private faction like the Carlyle Group or a corporate cutout that was created as a way of essentially taking the technology private and utilizing it for nefarious or for selfish purposes. I'm really speaking out as a member of the project because, after all, you know, DARPA was created, its congressional mandate was to prevent military surprise. So in one way I'm speaking out, because if we don't create a system of global teleportation led and administered by the United States and its allies, some other country or terrorist group or organized criminal network can, and they can use it to enslave us. So I'm essentially still on the project now as an activist, a lawyer who was in the project, to prevent military surprise and to protect this great country and also to protect good people from the evil people that could exploit this technology if we don't standardize it now.
I asked you yesterday on the phone if you were familiar with Ben Rich, the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, I think the second director of it. They call him Mr. or Father of Stealth Technology, and he made this statement. I want to read it and then ask you to comment on it. We already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. Anything you can imagine, we already know how to do it. We now have technology to take ET home. No, it won't take someone's lifetime to do it. There is an error in the equations. We know what it is. We now have the capability to travel to the stars. And then the last thing I'll read and then get you to comment, there are two types of UFOs, the ones we build and the ones they build. Now, obviously, there was a great effort made to discredit Rich, but when you talk about people that are having, if you will, the last breaths of their life or the last moments of their life to kind of clear their conscience, that's a pretty famous guy to be making those statements, because even on his deathbed, are you familiar with James Goodall?
No, but I'm familiar with Ben Rich. I didn't meet him, but I'm familiar with that really telling statement he made. I can say this, that there were three defense contractors on the Mars Jump Room program: Parsons, Hughes, and Lockheed Skunk Works. In fact, I received specialized training over at Lockheed Skunk Works in the early part of the summer of 1981, before my first jump to Mars in July of 81. They had me in a kind of a videodrome type setup where I was given a gun. Basically, it was a proxy for a firearm. And I stood in a room, and they were bringing videos up in front of me, behind me, and on my left and right to sort of sensitize me or give me almost sort of Pavlovian condition to look around for predators on the horizon and even close. And there was a woman with a very kind of affecting, thick British accent saying, "Now look 90 degrees to your left. What's there?" And I did that for several hours. So when I got to Mars and I had the status of being essentially a guard of my fellow civilian visitors, I had been conditioned to look at 90 and 180 degree angles constantly. I was doing it like every 15 and 30 seconds, really as, let's say, the guard in a military detachment would. So I can connect Lockheed Skunk Works, Ben Rich's very company, to the Mars program. And I think if you examine or compare his claims against mine, my claims are really encompassed by his. He essentially corroborates me, because he's talking about our capacity to go to the stars. All I've described is a device that you walked into that was virtually identical with an elevator in a corporate office building. In fact, it was the dual use of the elevator within the core part of that Hughes building in El Segundo. And we checked in on the fifth floor and then went back in the elevator, and it went up to the top floor, which is the eighth floor of that building. And after about 5 minutes, lights would start flashing, and the elevator would morph from a box-like structure into a cylindrical one. And then after about 10 minutes of that, back into a box-like structure. And when the far wall opened up, we were in the sub-basement of one of seven or eight U.S. facilities on the Red Planet. So imagine walking into an elevator and going to another planet. That's how advanced we were in the early 1980s. That was 35 years ago. I'm 56 years old. I first went to Mars when I was 19. Okay, in the summer of 1981. I was almost 20. Okay, so there has been essentially a multi-generational cover-up of these technologies, and the space program has been far more advanced and has involved far more people than the American people were told. And because they've been footing the bill, and our model of government is supposed to be based on the consent of the governed, I'm speaking out because the American people deserve to know that our great, uniquely great American civilization developed time travel by 1970 and was utilizing one of those forms of time travel to reach Mars by the late 1970s. I was the first American child to Tesla teleport, but 10 years later, I was by no means the first American to serve in the Jump Room program. There were hundreds of people who were going. I'm just one of the handful who have essentially risked our lives to speak out, because the American people deserve to know what we have accomplished. And Mars visitation is one of those great feats of our uniquely American civilization.
Would you share, too, if you would, about Howard Hughes? Because this is a good example. I told Andrew about the same time in the early 60s, my dad was a technical writer for Howard Hughes. He was a geophysicist by training. I mean, Hughes had thousands of employees. But share the story of Howard Hughes, how the powers that be can fake anybody's death and keep them alive out of sight, if you would. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, in the 1983 time frame, 82-83 time frame, I don't have specific dates because, again, these experiences were 30 years ago. I was instructed not to make diary entries or take notes about what we were doing. It was highly classified. We could actually potentially be eliminated if we did something that harmed operational security. So I'm working from memory. But in the 1982-83 time frame, when I was really going there frequently, there was an incident in which my fellow jumper, Bernard Mendez, collapsed, probably from hypoxia, on the Martian surface. I was about a mile from the closest jump room, and I looked down at his body. I checked. I could see that he was breathing. I found a pulse, and I said, I'm either going to save Bernie and carry him into the jump room, or he's going to be eaten here by one of the predator species. There were about six or seven carnivores, two of which were inevitably lethal if you were anywhere around them and they wanted to make lunch of you. So I did a fireman's carry. I was about 180 pounds, and in the peak of my health as a young man, I was 21, 22 years old in peak condition. I wasn't certainly not an athlete, but I was physically fit. And I put him over my right shoulder and carried him in, actually dropping him on the ground a few times. And when I finally got back to the jump room that we called the corkscrew, because it had kind of a conch shell sort of Fibonacci-based structure, a kind of a spiral structure, I actually was almost falling over myself, and I kind of tumbled Bernard into the floor of the jump room, and I said, I don't know whether he's still alive. He was out in the field. Get him home. And Bernie ended up waking up in a Los Angeles hospital, probably Daniel Freeman there near Marina Del Rey, near the jump room building. And as a result, somebody that Mendez knew from the 1970s, who Richard Nixon had asked to find, Hughes, That is to say that Mendez had been selected by Nixon and had been looking for Hughes after his alleged death in April of 1976. You may recall that there was a picture drawn of an emaciated, sort of demented Howard Hughes, who died in a terrible condition while flying into Houston, Texas in April of 1976. Well, as a result of my rescue of Mendez, somebody that Hughes had known for many years, Mr. Hughes, who was still quite alive and had an office on the fourth floor of that building in El Segundo, where the West Coast jump room to Mars was, asked to meet me. And I was walked into his office, and he said, "Oh, this is Andy. Are you Andy?" "Oh, hi, Andy. Howard Hughes." And because I was a bright, well-read teenager and college student, I had read all the accounts of the Howard Hughes with long hair and fingernails and peeing in mason jars while eating black walnut ice cream or watching Ice Station Zebra over and over again on a movie screen. So I knew Howard Hughes to be deceased. Well, he wasn't. Howard Hughes' death was faked in 1976 to protect him from assassination or abduction when he was working on sensitive defense technical projects linked to the CIA. Those projects included the Glomar Explorer, which was an advanced submersible that would lift a Soviet submarine off the floor of the Pacific Ocean, and did, and the Mars Jump Room device and the program to send American astronauts there. I only later, when I compared notes with my fellow jumper William Whitecrow, and then had the opportunity to discuss Howard Hughes' survival after 1976. In fact, he died at age 93 in 2001, as established by the recent biographers of Hughes, who I spoke with and have done several radio shows with, Douglas Wellman, a former dean at USC, and Army Major General Mark Music. They have documented the fact that Hughes survived, and Whitecrow and I have been able to corroborate their research by saying, look, we interacted with Hughes at the El Segundo Jump Room building. Now, I went into his office maybe three or four times. He was very, very courteous and friendly in that initial meeting. But as I've described to Music and to Wellman, who are well aware of his bipolar trait, several other times when I went into Mr. Hughes' office, he was being brutal to his staff. He was basically in the negative phase of bipolar disorder and being extremely unkind to his staff. So he had this duality in his personality. But it was Hughes, and he was identified to me as Mr. Hughes. I just didn't appreciate the whole time I was on the program that it was Howard Hughes. But now we've corroborated that fact. And in fact, Hughes was a guest of honor by the leading staff of Project Pegasus at the one of the most popular Mexican restaurants in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I don't know if it's still there, but the Brown family owned it. It was called La Hacienda in Old Town Albuquerque. I think it may still be there. And when I was a child on the project in 1970, there was a rumor that there was going to be a VIP at lunch at the La Hacienda that day. And I asked my father what a VIP meant, and he explained a very important person. And I asked who the person was going to be, and he wouldn't tell me. I think they were keeping it secret. I then asked my dad's longtime friend and sometimes companion, Mary Constance Chavez, Connie, or she was also known as Pilly Chavez, who was the cashier at the La Hacienda, who this VIP was. And she whispered heatedly, sort of urgently in my ear, and explained who Howard Hughes was. So Hughes was a guest of honor. He was briefed on our time travel technologies at the La Hacienda restaurant in 1970. Well, Wellman and Music have established that when he went back to his girlfriend, Eva McClellan, in their double-wide outside of Montgomery, Alabama, Howard Hughes had kind of forsaken wealth accumulation and was living a very simple lifestyle with a lot of his basic clothing and so forth kept in these plastic boxes in their yard. That's why they've named their biography, The Real Hughes, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. Well, they've stated that in 1970, when he went back to stay with Eva McClellan, you know, essentially his third wife, she asked him, "Howard, where have you been and with who?" And he said, "Somewhere else in the country with star gazers." That's how Eva McClellan remembered it when she was interviewed by these biographers. But I said, no, that's not what he said. He probably said stargaters, because 2 years later, in Project Pegasus, stargates emerged that we were using to jump from 1972 to the year 2045. So I think that that Hughes was coining a phrase to sort of disguise from his third wife the fact that he'd been briefed on the time travel program. So I had actually been at a lunch that Hughes was a guest of honor at as a child on the project, and then had the privilege of meeting this great American when I was college age, and I was not just jumping across Earth, but jumping off planet utilizing a time travel technology. So the Mars cover-up is part of the cover-up of the true life and career of Howard Robard Hughes.
Would you also explain how, because this has been a question, I mean, it's always talked about, and you helped me to understand it, how even when you go into the past or jump into the past or, you know, forward into the future, that you can't affect the outcome if it just explain that, because, you know, it's a hard thing to wrap around your brain around, but yet when you do, it's really simple. Go ahead and explain that. In essence, why someone couldn't go back, and then I'll let you, if we've got time, to go into that you were shown the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. And again, ladies and gentlemen, you're getting the feeling that Andrew Basiago knows what he's talking about, and the details are so concise that he would stand any cross interrogation. But will you share that, why you can't affect the outcome of history? Because if they could, they'd go back, you know, and try and kill Jesus, you know, stop him. Now, obviously, as God's son, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, this is an area where sort of the semiotics of language really matter. So let me be clear. A time traveler from the future who goes back to the past can affect events. They're not just, you know, having a null effect on events. What they can't do is change what happened from the perspective of the present, which was the past's future. The reason in physics, and then I'll explain in practical terms, in the language of physics, when in the present a present event undergoes the so-called collapse of the wave function, that present event is transmuted into a past event that is a fixed element in the time-space continuum. In practical language, what I'm saying is that when a time traveler from the future goes back to the past, they can affect what happens there, or they cannot. They can either have no effect or an effect. For example, by jumping from spring of 1972 via a device called a plasma confinement chamber, I was sent back to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the day that Lincoln spoke there, which was November 19th of 1863, and was photographed there in the so-called Josephine Cobb image of Lincoln Gettysburg. I'm the boy standing in the center, near ground, foreground of that photograph. So by going back, I retrocausally placed my presence there that day and was photographed. So I affected the events of that day, the day that Lincoln gave his famous Gettysburg Address. But from the perspective of the future, you can't go back and change the past, because the events there are deeply embedded in the time-space continuum. And another practical constraint is, when you time travel to the past and are there in the present, you're having present effects on the original event. So you can't change what's happening. You can only contribute to it. You can only affect it, if at all. Okay? Does that make more sense? It's hard to wrap our minds around, because we learn linear causation from the time that we're infants. And it's hard to understand events that are retrocausally caused, where essentially the cause follows the effect. So by going back as a time traveler, I was there on November 19th, 1863, and I didn't create a second version of that day in Gettysburg. I contributed or affected that day, the events of that particular day in history, the day Lincoln spoke there. So by going back, I didn't change that event just because I was from the future, any more than if I had ridden the train from Washington with Lincoln. Okay? I got there at that moment in time space from the future, but in a causal relationship to present events that was indistinguishable from somebody of that time who didn't time travel there. So another practical consideration of that is that anybody who does time travel to the past has whatever effect they can in the past's present. So it's impossible to change the events that go on there from the perspective of history, because time is linear, and because the causal effects you have are already embedded in the event. In that sense, you can only go back in time to fulfill what history knows you did. Okay? Now, in the case of the film footage of the Jesus's, who was a real historical figure, he was a real human being, I'll leave it to people's own sense of faith and conscience to determine whether or not he was the Son of God and our Savior, as I have accepted and I'm not hiding that fact, and I'm a believer with an IQ of 168. Okay? So not all, we cannot try to discredit Christian faith by attacks on believers. I've got the IQ to analyze this, and I've determined that Scripture is revealed truth and that Jesus is our Savior. But I did not see his resurrection. I only learned of it from my father. What I did see was a 20 to 30 minute film of a hologram generated by a device called a chronovisor that showed the actual crucifixion of the actual Jesus. And I can say, as somebody who was then a Catholic Sunday school child, that the actual crucifixion of Jesus was entirely in accord with the gospel accounts, including things like the crown, you know, Jesus' emaciated condition, the crown of thorns, the fact that he was nailed through the wrists and feet, the sign above his head, the fact that the Roman centurion Longinus took the top end of his spear and lunged upward on one leg to pierce Jesus' side, the fact that women came to pray at the foot of his cross, the fact that there were two men being crucified behind him at different angles, and that even that the sky grew dark at a certain point in his crucifixion. And I have to tell you, I had never seen anybody's killing, certainly as, you know, a public school kid from New Jersey. I was 10 and a half years old, but it was extremely harrowing. That's the word I was trying to seek yesterday. It was harrowing to watch a film of a hologram of Jesus's execution. Now, what then happened is when we walked outside, my father then explained to Connie Chavez and I, who was the other guest that he invited to that viewing, that his team also recovered moving holographic images of a scene 3 days later in which there was a flash of light in Jesus' crypt. Jesus, two angels appeared, not one, as some of the Gospels say, but two angels appeared. Jesus stood up, and all three of them pushed the stone away from the opening of the crypt, and the three of them walked out of Jesus' crypt. So I have to bear witness to what my father told me. He was a believer himself. He was a man of truth and honor, and he never would have informed an old friend who was such an earnest believer as Connie Chavez, or his number five child, his number three son, as he used to call me. That's how he identified me to Harold Agnew. Here's Andrew, my number three son. He never would have deceived me. He would never have deceived anybody, much less one of his children, about the fact that his team also recovered moving holographic images of the resurrection. So I'm posing this information to the public because I learned it, because it would be disingenuous not to reveal what my father told me, and also for us to ponder the consideration. Given the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, we have to ask whether our government has actually concealed Jesus' resurrection to not establish or prohibit the free exercise of either Christianity or non-Christian religions. I think a political and perhaps even a religiously advised decision was made to conceal this footage. Perhaps the Vatican informed the U.S. government, don't show it. People should come to Jesus through faith, not through movies. But that's what happened. I didn't see the footage of the resurrection, but I learned it from my dad, and I believe he was telling the truth.
Well, you could also postulate another answer, that obviously the evil that has been personified in specific really evil people on the planet and behind the scenes with the secret societies, they're the ones that blocked it, and it wasn't for a constitutional issue but for a later, if you will, manifestation of what the Bible would call the Antichrist, he who takes the place of Jesus Christ. And I would say this, the sinister nature of all the wars that have been fought and everything contrary to the word and the character of God are seemingly being controlled. You spoke about the bankers and their blood sacrifice, their cannibalism, their allegiance to Lucifer. That's what Jesus, I think, meant when he said the love of money is the root of all evil. Not the money itself, but the love of it. And money to them is power, but the power only achieves a specific, if you will, lowerarchy in Satan's hell that's still on Earth. So I would just say this, my response to what you just said, I don't think it was a matter of, quote, conscience or even the Constitution. I believe that obviously, and I think there are enough people who are Catholic theologians who have been murdered, Malachi Martin being a preeminent one. People try and dismiss him. But now you see the war in the Catholic Church where the Pope has just absolutely abdicated, or not abdicated, but basically passed his decree that there is no heaven, there is no hell, Jesus isn't the only way to the Father, and that everybody's going to live in a giant tent and all are welcome. So I would say this, the technology that you are describing would obviously have been utilized, just as you guys utilized it for one purpose. Obviously, evil had its way. A multi-star general with more stars, and I'll be kind of vague here, that most people know exists, told me that Majestic 12 was split into two factions, the Magi, which were the good guys, and the Magicians, which were the bad guys. And, you know, it just it matches up with biblical truth. It matches up with Cain and Abel. It matches up with everything that we see. There's always the, quote, presence of free will. So I would just encourage, you know, everyone to think about this and pray about it. By the way, Andrew, I've always told everybody, I think you've heard me before, take this stuff to the Lord in prayer, because it's going to be so hard for people to wrap their heads around this. But again, ladies and gentlemen, independent of Andrew Basiago, I have five people known to me, some of them are very close, one of them's dead now, that have gone into such excruciating detail that the only way, and Doug, you'll basically know this, that's why you sequester witnesses so they don't take other guys' stuff, but who completely validate what Andrew is telling you tonight. And we can't cover the whole thing, Andrew, tonight, but I want to thank you because, again, you have so many pieces of the puzzle, and I believe right now God is taking that piece of Mars and putting it into the greater framework, and I think that people are going to be, their minds are going to be blown, and I see kind of what I've tried to do on talk radio for 25 years is to prepare people for the greatest, if you will, mind melt that they're going to encounter. And that's why I think that, you know, again, over the years, you've had reception, but you've also had ridicule, you've been mocked, you've been, and by a certain individual, I won't name him, but even the torture you were, you know, subjected to was done by someone who supposedly sees the future. I'll leave it at that. So the point is that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to encourage you that you're listening. We're blessed to listen to somebody who has an inside knowledge. And again, 1 week ago today, I got a call, and they basically said what Dr. Basiago is saying. This is what they're stating. Thank you so much, Steve, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks. You know, when John Glenn returned to the Earth after orbiting around it, he was given a ticker tape parade in New York City, down through the boulevards of New York City. I'm an American astronaut as well, and I actually went farther more frequently, and I've been accused wrongly of atrocities. So that's an aspect of the, you know, the fulfillment, for example, of the biblical prophecy that the ways of men shall wax worse and worse. We have been persecuting our space heroes to perpetuate these cover-ups, and I haven't just been faulted or mocked. I've been wrongfully accused of committing atrocities. So I just want to end on that note. I also want to thank you personally. Steve Quayle, you are a prince among men, and you have an incredibly advanced level of insight to support me over the years, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Well, blessings to you, my brother, and Doug and Joe. Thank you so much. I know it takes a lot of, you know, how do I say this, conviction to allow us to come on and talk about this. And Andrew, we'll be talking, obviously, and then the item I discussed with you last night, I'll keep you in the loop on that, and it's, when it comes to pass, you'll be there.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. What a very interesting story. I'd love to be able to see through your eyes. Steve, when we Pastor Langford, Eric, what are we going to do? Are we going to just continue to roll?
Yeah, we'll continue to roll. Just bring us back on, because tonight we're going to, I asked David to pray for people. This is Halloween, and I call it Halloween. We need to be praying for all the believers, and David and I are going to talk about the transformation that has to take place in the people of God's lives in order to deal with the coming days ahead.
Steve, we're not gonna take the break. We'll just bring on Pastor Langford in a minute or two here. But just going back to Andrew's story real quick, you said that you have. I've heard an interesting story from one other person about Mars, and when I learned Andrew was coming on, John contacted him and got the story again. So I'm going to compare the stories and see if there's any similarities there. But you said you knew other people that share a similar story.
Five different people. One of the highest ranking generals in the U.S. military, active duty. And, you know, again, to tell people this, there are 28 levels of security clearance above top secret. Some of it's special compartmentalized, you know, some of it's cosmic. But the point is that there are people that can validate this, and I'm not kidding.